Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A year ago, Wall Street investment bank Bear Stearns traded at $170 a share. On Friday, it traded at $30. Last night, in an emergency deal pushed through by the Fed, J.P. Morgan Chase bought Bear Stearns and all of its woe for $2 a share. The party is over. This hour, On Point, the crisis on Wall Street and what it means for the American economy and the rest of the world. Joining me now from New York is Dennis Berman, Global Deals Editor for The Wall Street Journal. Dennis, thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Tom.
Crisis in your lead headline in The Wall Street Journal this morning. Reuters has a headline, Apocalypse Now. What is going on?
Well, I think Apocalypse Now might be a bit of an overstatement right now, but crisis it most certainly is. With the confidence draining out of Wall Street, firms like Bear Stearns don't have access to the capital they need to do the trading and the business that is their lifeline. So once the liquidity flows out of a firm like Bear Stearns, it's essentially dead in the water. And their admission today their concession, really, of a $2 share price was really a sign that right now Bear Stearns is worthless. The liabilities that the firm has, the exposures on things like bad mortgages and securities linked to those bad mortgages are greater than the value of the firm itself.
$2 a share, and that includes a great big pretty tower on Madison Avenue in New York City. I mean, $200 million-plus for the whole company. It's a kind of number we've seen associated with annual bonuses for some people in finance.
It's quite incredible. Some people have made that much money. There's certainly hedge fund managers who make far more than that. And if you looked at the collective holdings of the Bear Stearns executives prior to last week, they'd certainly be far greater than $200 million. So it is a crisis indeed. But I think it's probably a step too far to declare an apocalypse.
We're not going there, but the headlines out there are scary, and we're just trying to figure it out. Dennis, so the Fed and J.P. Morgan closeted all weekend, and out they come with this deal. Do you think J.P. Morgan had said its investment banking arm that they might find a buying opportunity in here, but do you think they wanted to buy Bear Stearns, or did they have the arm twisted until it almost broke by the Fed to do it?
It's probably a little bit of both. Think about what J.P. Morgan is doing here. The Fed is backstopping J.P. Morgan on some of the Bear securities. So the end owner of some of these securities could well be you and me and all of our listeners, which means the American taxpayer. Was it a good deal for J.P. Morgan? In that regard, yes. But it also requires a lot of work and a lot of capital to put together two firms. So there is some risk exposure for J.P. Morgan. So it's going to take some time to determine whether this is a good deal or not. But that said, a price of virtually zero is certainly a good place to start.
You're in New York. You're hearing the chatter, listening to the bankers and everybody else there. What are people saying? Does it sound like, perhaps, with this deal, the Fed and J.P. Morgan may have put the blocks to this downward slide? Or do people expect for the rest of this week, for the rest of this month, for the rest of our, I don't know how long, for more trouble to keep popping up, for more banks to emerge in bad trouble, as we saw with Bear Stearns?
Well, there's certainly more layoffs coming to Wall Street, so the mood in New York is pretty dire. The securities industry is such a big part of life here in Manhattan and the greater New York area. So there's a lot of fear and a lot of concern that a big number of those jobs are going to be vaporized. Also, this week, there are going to be a lot of earnings reports from those big banks, and they're expected to take quite a large number of write-offs in the process. But the Fed did an historic and certainly unprecedented thing over the weekend. It essentially opened up its coffers to broker-dealers, not the banks where we put our deposits, mm-hmm. but the firms like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, Morgan Stanley, that are big traders on the street. And they said, bring us your securities and we'll give you cash for them. And that's unprecedented, and it's supposed to calm the markets. And right now, looking at my Reuters screen, they're down about 66 points, which if you said that to someone last night, would you take it? Most people probably would.
People fearing it could have been much worse. We don't know how that will be by the end of the day. Of course, Asia wasn't pretty today. Looking on here, as you say, spigots opened now for these big broker-dealers, and that is historic. What does that mean? Is the Fed essentially taking on the risk of the entire subprime mess and more than that now?
that's, I think, sort of the undercurrent of what they've done here. And it really speaks to sort of a historic culmination of what's been going on the street over the last 10, 15, 20 years. And that's an evolution away from a regulated entity, off-balance sheet financing, hedge funds, derivatives, all sorts of securities and permutations that really never fell under a big regulatory purview. So right now the Fed is playing catch-up and in a way that I think a lot of people could view as detrimental to the taxpayer. But from the Fed's point of view, the consequences of a Bear Stearns sort of going kaput in a moment's notice are too dire to sort of play theoretical chess with. You have to stop the problem while you can, even if it means creating new precedent while you're going.
Describe that downside risk for us, because this is amounting potentially to a bailout underway right now. Taxpayers paying for all those years when we saw that glittering party on Wall Street with very little oversight, diminishing regulation, as you say. What is the Fed worried about that's prodding it to take on the moral hazard of bailing out these guys after they played knowingly for so many years this way?
The Fed's quite concerned about the very system itself seizing up, no one willing to lend money to anyone else. And that could create a cascading function, if you will, of one broker-dealer after the next going under as it needs capital to run its business. So the possibilities of that happening and derivative securities, which are based around sort of the failure or success of firms, they're called credit default swaps, that creates a whole other cascading chain that could set off billions and potentially trillions of dollars worth of liabilities, and the end result of all those changes are really unknown. But I think it is also important to note that the media plays a role in all of this as well. If you study the panic of 1907 or 1929, pictures of people lining up at banks is sort of creates a problematic situation. In some ways, we are all dependent on a collective belief, a belief that when our money goes into the bank, the money stays there. In reality, it does not. It's lent out almost immediately. So the minute you say there's a run on the bank is the minute that perhaps it's created, and that's a real risk unto itself. So it's very sensitive times for the folks who are covering this as well.
Of course, absolutely, and everybody needs to be cool-headed. Of course, it wasn't the media, at least not you and me, as far as I know, Dennis, taking home those big bonuses for all those years. And Bear Stearns in particular, as the first one to go, remind our listeners who may not have followed this closely, Bear Stearns had and has a particular reputation here.
Well, its reputation is one of meritocracy and almost independence from the rest of the Wall Street infrastructure. These guys were really smart guys, a lot of immigrant folks who just worked hard and were smart and rose up in the culture. Now, another interesting...
That's one way of putting it. I mean, the New York Times, Gretchen Morgenson over the weekend talking about recklessness, greed, brass knuckles, didn't follow the rules, not a good citizen.
Well, I think there's certainly an irony. Bear Stearns had lots of practices that you'd probably find in lots of other places on Wall Street, and that is certainly the irony here. You or me or anyone else perhaps buys a house that's too big, can't meet the mortgage, there's no one there to step in for us. If you start a business, start a restaurant, it doesn't go well, tough luck. But if you're in the securities business, where your business is at the heart of the financial system that is so essential to Americans, you've got someone backing you up. And that really is sort of one of the... great ironies and potentially great disgraces of all of this. The millions and millions, tens of millions of dollars in personal wealth created for so many people on Wall Street, and in the end, it's the taxpayer that, at least right now, is potentially more on the hook than ever before.
What a picture. And not just that, but of course, people's 401k and everything else that they've got in the game, individual citizens' skin in the game. Dennis Berman at the Wall Street Journal, global deals editor there, joining us from New York. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Appreciate it.
Let's see. Joining us now from Bethesda, Maryland, Douglas Elmendorf, former Federal Reserve Bank economist and a senior economist at the White House Council of Economic Advisors. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the Treasury Department. He's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Douglas Elmendorf, thanks a lot for being with us.
Hello, Thomas. Good to be here.
You say there is no rule book for an economic crisis, suggesting that's where we are right now. How do you see what's going on?
Well, we are certainly in a financial crisis, and what the Fed is trying to do is to prevent that financial crisis from spilling over and becoming a full-fledged economic crisis. I think they have shown great creativity, imagination, really, in moving beyond their traditional tools for adjusting the path of the economy and trying to work directly at the blockages in financial markets. But it is undoubtedly a perilous time.
How are we going to know if what the Fed's up to is working? How are you judging?
Well, the Fed is certainly in a reactive stance, and that's unfortunate. But I think hard to avoid because much of what is happening cannot really be predicted. I think they are going a bit day-to-day. As I say, that's not a place you want the central bank to be. But I don't think there is a way to see all the way to the end of this problem now. The way I judge is that if, as problems have popped up in the ability of financial institutions to borrow and lend to each other and thus ultimately to borrow and lend to households and businesses, the Fed has focused its attention on the area of trouble and tried to find a way to keep the financial system humming. And I think they've been hit by a succession of shocks a number of times in the past 6 months. It's looked like financial conditions were improving, only to have them deteriorate again. And I think only time will tell whether this recent set of moves is enough or whether further moves will be required down the road.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the crisis on Wall Street. J.P. Morgan and the Fed bail out banking giant Bear Stearns. And we've seen the markets in Asia not doing well. We'll see what the U.S. markets do today. We've been joined from Bethesda, Maryland by Douglas Elmendorf, former economist at the Federal Reserve, now senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. We're joined now as well from New York by Peter Coy, economics editor for Business Week magazine. Peter Coy, thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi, Doug.
What's the buzz on the street, Peter? Is the banking world looking at this as a punctuation mark here? Is it going to stop this? Or are we going to see more of these quakes and falls?
Yes, it is a punctuation mark. Unfortunately, it's not a period.
Yeah.
It's more like an exclamation mark.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the stock market is down today. Not too much. It's not like it's crashing or anything. But you would like to see a little more cheer over such a dramatic action over the weekend. We're in a very, very unstable point now, as Doug and Dennis said, where things, we just don't know how things are going to turn out. You might call it like multiple equilibria. There could be a high-level equilibrium where kind of everything settles out around where it is now or even higher.
Mm-hmm.
Or they could just tumble to, you know, how far down we can't even say.
Peter, that kind of talk from somebody who's sitting in New York and who follows it all the time can be very scary for people around the country who have retirement savings, college savings, and all the rest in there. I mean, people have their noses pressed up against the window here, but what is on the other side? I'm looking at a headline here, you know, panic at the Fed, fire sale at Bear Stearns. Are we tiptoeing along some risk of a, forget recession, are we talking about depression here? What is going on?
Yeah, I wouldn't say depression, but you know, people are talking about the possibility of a serious recession, and I have a cover story out now called "Welcome to the Waking Up to the Recession," which talks about that very idea that, you know, going back to what you were saying before about bailing out the gilded bankers with their zillion-dollar incomes, you know, that kind of talk is very understandable. Nobody likes to bail people out of bad decisions. The trouble is, if we get all righteous about this and say, we're not going to bail anyone out, then we run the risk of cutting off our noses to spite our face and making matters really worse. So, I mean, I would accept a bailout, a kind of a messy solution to this that let off a lot of people scot-free if it meant saving the financial system from a meltdown.
Douglas Elmendorf, I assume most Americans would feel the same in the end. Nobody wants us to go, you know, way down in the tank on this, though there's going to be a lot of grinding of teeth about what's gone on. But how much intervention can the Federal Reserve Bank exercise here and not create a moral hazard so big that it looks like you can do anything on Wall Street, and at the end of the day, the American people will bail you out and off you go with your millions?
I share that concern. I agree with Peter that I would accept a messy outcome now over a full-fledged economic crisis. But I think that ideally we try to separate preventing the next domino from falling from making the current shareholders of a financial institution whole. And with Bear Stearns, it has worked out roughly that way, which is to say the shareholders have ended up with essentially nothing out of investment that was worth a lot fairly recently, but with nothing because at the time the Fed had to step in, the firm, because of the withdrawal of liquidity by its people it was dealing with, the firm was essentially worthless. So I feel bad for the individuals involved, but I think it is the right outcome for our economy that the shareholders have ended up taking home essentially nothing at this point.
The CEO at Bear Stearns worth $1 billion plus a year ago, last January, now worth maybe $13 million, chump change on Wall Street.
That's right. I mean, obviously for most Americans, including me, $13 million is a lot of money. But again, the shareholders and the managers and employees who held a lot of the shares have taken very large losses. And that's the way I think it has to be. And I look down the road, if and when the Fed has to take action to benefit other institutions in order to prevent the sort of cascade of defaults, I hope that intervention will be designed to the extent possible to prevent the cascade of defaults, but not to rescue the people who are currently holding control of these companies.
Big needle to thread. Peter, explain for us this kind of what sounds like an open spigot that the Fed is now offering the major broker-dealers, the major banks for this next period. What the Fed is willing to take on their to loan them money to cover their bad debt, the subprime mortgages and all that, until that settles out? What?
The Fed has had a so-called discount window for decades and decades, which is where banks could borrow money if they really needed it in a pinch, and it was very lightly used. Well, starting last summer, the Fed put in some changes that created a new thing, a Treasury auction facility, term auction facility, that was very much like the discount window, but it was still for banks. The difference over the weekend is now investment banks, that is, ones that aren't directly regulated by the Fed, are eligible for this kind of thing. And, you know, as long as it was banks that were a little bit under the Fed's thumb, you could say, well, they got a handle on this. They're not going to make any stupid lending mistakes. But now the lending goes to firms that the Fed really doesn't know nearly as much about and cannot control as much. So,
but the spigot is open anyway. This is an open-ended kind of offer of backstop.
It's much more open-ended and exposes the Fed and indirectly us, the taxpayers, to a lot more risk for sure. But it obviously is intended to decrease risks to the system as a whole by putting a floor under how bad things can get.
Wow, what a picture. And the whole world is watching.
Tom, can I jump in with you? The whole world is watching is a critical point here that, you know, Dennis and Doug haven't brought this up yet, but the dollar is falling today.
Against the euro like crazy.
And the yen, you know, we're down to 96 or something on the yen to the dollar.
Wow.
And the concern is that the Fed is constrained not only by this moral hazard stuff we're talking about and the cost of the taxpayer, as bad as those issues are, it's constrained by the fear that if it cuts rates too much and gets too generous, that it could start a real run on the dollar, not just a mild decline, which so far has been relatively salutary, but a real panicky attack on the dollar's value.
We're going to look at that. Let's go to London first for a moment to see how things look from across that pond. Gillian Tett joins us, capital markets editor for the Financial Times. Gillian, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, hello, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
Does it look from London as though the Fed has stepped in and J.P. Morgan in a way that may put a full stop to this problem, or does the plummeting dollar mean a sort of vote of no confidence, or at least not yet, from Europe?
Well, currently the Fed finds itself in a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of situation, in the sense that the markets are demanding radical action from the U.S. authorities, but the very fact that the Fed has taken such radical action is confirming everyone's worst fears that we do indeed have a crisis on our hands. And these days, the global markets are so interconnected that if a crisis is breaking in Wall Street, it's affecting the City of London as well.
So what do the financial markets look like there today, Gillian?
Well, the big issue on everyone's mind is the question of whether Bear Stearns really was an isolated case, as the authorities and, of course, bankers are trying to argue, or whether it points to a pattern that could cause stresses at other banking institutions as well. And this morning, we've seen European bank shares fall very, very sharply indeed, amid fears that actually we could see a replay of the kinds of patterns of events at Bear Stearns over in Europe too.
When you look on how these American banks have behaved over the last decade, is this in line with the way big European banks do business? Do the American banks look sort of more, Wild West cowboy style or familiar?
Well, the pattern of specific subprime lending to mortgage borrowers mm-hmm. was a particularly U.S. phenomenon. There's been certainly a lot of crazy lending in the U.K. housing market as well, but it does seem that subprime lending in the U.S. was a particularly made-in-America problem. However, the key point to realize is this, that those subprime loans have been sliced and diced and sold to investors all over the world. And although the techniques for that slicing and dicing started by and large in America, in fact, a lot of that financial production, the financial factory, if you like, has actually been located in London in recent years. And so the type of innovation that we've been seeing in London has been incredibly complicated and thus has thrown up incredible risks too.
Gillian, with such big questions then about stock markets in New York, in London, in Asia, where is money going?
Well, that is one of the huge issues right now. The global financial system is certainly not short of cash right now. Not only do we have sovereign wealth funds sitting on huge amounts of money from rising oil prices and other factors, but many mainstream financial institutions, such as pension funds or other mainstream asset managers, are cash-rich too. By and large, they're pouring this money into risk-free assets. You've got a lot of buying of commodities, of gold. You've got a lot of buying of government bonds, or else they're simply sitting on it as cash. But the scary thing right now is that that may not be enough. I mean, there is a major bank this morning in Europe that's been telling its clients not to leave money on deposit in banks unless these are banks with strong political protection from their local governments.
In other words, banks that the government will step in and back if they get in trouble.
Absolutely.
Wow. Let's hear from our listeners. Nancy is calling from Cedar Falls, Iowa. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to hear your guest's comment on three factors that I think have helped to bring us where we are today.
Okay.
First is the failure of regulators to police credit quality.
Mm-hmm.
Second is the complicity of the debt rating agencies.
Right.
And third, and I'm sure most important, is the fact that we have the Fed through monetary policy trying to keep us out of inflation when we have had for many years in this country an incredibly inflationary fiscal policy that it seems to me is unsustainable. So I'd like to hear your guest's comment on those things. Your comments off the air.
Got it. It's a plate full. Douglas Elmendorf, let's come first to you on the last one. The Fed now may be torn between where growth goes and what happens with inflation. I mean, is the Federal Reserve Bank in a tenable, workable position here in meeting the challenges the country faces?
Fed has very tough problems it faces. I actually disagree with the listener about the short-term effects of fiscal policy. I think our fiscal policy has been very detrimental to the country's long-term economic health. Hasn't been the particular problem facing the Federal Reserve in making monetary policy. The Fed has responded beginning in 2001, really, to a collapse of a high-tech bubble, and it responded by lowering interest rates. And it turned out that in order to keep the economy moving forward and to push the unemployment rate back down from that recession, the Fed had to lower interest rates to 1% in 2003. That did sow some of the seeds of this housing bubble. But I think the bigger issues are the first two points that the listener raised, which is the failure of financial regulation. That applies both to the initial lending for mortgages. It applies to the process by which mortgages were securitized and rated by credit ratings agencies.
Right.
It applies to the risk that banks were taking, both on their balance sheet and off, but very close to their balance sheet in the form of these structured investment vehicles that were also not being regulated effectively. So I think the principal point we need to address going forward to reduce the risk of this sort of event recurring is to have a much more vigorous regulatory policy.
But Peter Coy, are we at the end of an era then? Is this debunking the sort of philosophy of nearly a generation now when it comes to how banks ought to be treated, how markets ought to be trusted? I remember sitting here last summer when the party was going so strong. Novelist Tom Wolfe was writing about it and saying, you know, how long can this go? And are taxpayers going to end up holding the bag? And economists say, no, no, this is all great. We're moving toward new efficiencies. Is all that debunked now?
I don't know if end of an era. It's certainly an end of a cycle. The problem is that these things do repeat themselves. You know, what is it? The first time is a tragedy. The second time is comedy. And the third time, I don't know what's going to happen next time. But
third time you're broke.
I have a feeling it's going to repeat itself, that we're going to go through a period of penitence, and we're going to try to get – we'll do all the right things, and then the abuses are going to start creeping back in again, and we'll be right back where we are maybe 10 years from now.
I guess that depends on where things end up and how badly people get burned right now. Let's get a call from Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've been following the housing and credit bubbles for some time, in large part due to your excellent coverage on these subjects. And I got 6 months ago, I became very concerned about my holdings of U.S. equities. So I basically moved everything out into anything non-dollar denominated.
Right.
Global bond funds, Swiss francs, Japanese yen, not all of it. And now I'm looking at what the I've been hoping the Fed has been sincere on their stated strong dollar policy, but it seems to me that what they're obviously trying to do is to get everybody that holds dollars to end up paying for this thing, and all these, you know, all the bear bailouts. That's going to be small change to what people are you know, shopping around now, which is a congressional bailout of the entire housing and financial sectors, and that'll just, in my view, it looks like that'll just tank the dollar. And I'm an American. I'm a patriotic American. I don't want to get rid of my dollars.
But your money is overseas. But even that doesn't necessarily make you safe. If you've got them in the Hong Kong stock market today, that's trouble too. Gillian Tett, how do you look at that? Does the dollar look poised to go further down? I mean, Americans may have moved their money abroad and still seen it shrivel up if they're in, for example, Asian markets recently.
Well, I think there are two things going on here. Firstly, I mean, currencies are like any other asset. I mean, if you have a lot of houses on the market, the price of houses will fall. If you have a lot of dollars out there, the value of the dollar relative to other currencies will fall too. And so an awful lot of the concern right now is that the Fed is going to end up essentially printing more dollars to get us out of this hole, and that's going to hurt the value of the currency. On top of that, we have a much broader, more systemic concern about not just any one institution on Wall Street, but the entire Wall Street model of finance, the way that finance has been practiced in the past decade. And so that's creating a lot of anxiety out there amongst global investors.
Do European markets feel sturdy, or do they also feel, you know, teetering?
Well, the problem right now is there isn't a lot of places for investors to hide. And as I said earlier, certainly European financial institutions today have been suffering quite a pummeling in the market due to concern that Europe has a number of financial institutions with problems too.
Boy, what a picture. Gillian Tett in London, please stand by. Peter Coy at Businessweek magazine, it's been great having you with us. Thank you so much for joining us, Peter.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the crisis on Wall Street, J.P. Morgan, and the Fed bailout. Banking giant Bear Stearns over the weekend. Financial markets around the world, well, they're still not happy. How's your little nest egg doing? Gillian Tett has joined us from London. She's capital markets editor for the Financial Times. Douglas Elmendorf is with us, former economist at the Federal Reserve, now at the Brookings Institution. Joining us right now from Palm Springs, California, Bill Fleckenstein is here, president of Fleckenstein Capital, manages a hedge fund based in Seattle, co-author of Greenspan's Bubbles, The Age of Ignorance at the Federal Reserve. Bill Fleckenstein, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're in finance, yet you're saying that the Fed, J.P. Morgan, maybe should not be bailing out big banks, should not be bailing out Bear Stearns. Why not?
Well, the policies of the Federal Reserve and in terms of what Greenspan did of printing too much money, creating a creating misallocations of capital, which then led to problems, which then led to bailouts, while at the same time continuing to champion deregulation, is exactly why we are in this particular spot. Now that we're in this spot, nobody wants to see Bear Stearns collapse lead to other calamities. But what we now have done is put ourselves in a position where, okay, now we're bailing out a brokerage firm, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And while the shareholders didn't get bailed out, and I sympathize with anyone who was caught up in that mess, where are we going to draw the line? How are we going to stop this from happening again? What hasn't been said and what needs to be said is, okay, folks, we have this mess. We're going to clean it up, and then we're going to be sure that it never happens again. If we were attempting to solve the Bear Stearns issue and at the same time saying, oh, by the way, we're going to make sure it doesn't happen again,
mm-hmm.
that would be one thing. But I don't detect any sense of, oh, gee, we got to stop this from happening. It's we want to just get this past us and we get back to business as usual, which is, again, how we got here. And they're not going to. One of the problems is that the housing bubble, which sort of bailed out the equity bubble and the securitization that led to this mortgage paper going all over the world,
right,
is in these financial institutions, and that debt's unsupported. Meanwhile, the accounting in many of these institutions is so bad you can't know what's really there, which is how Bear Stearns can have an $80 book value and be taken out of $2.
It's so pretty wild.
There is a whole nested layer of problems that have been ignored for so long, and all we tend to do. I mean, look after long-term capital,
yep.
What reforms came out of it? We continue to deregulate more and more, and now we're here.
Jillian, I want to come to you in London on whether there might be a consensus for tightening up there. But Doug Elmendorf, first to you in Washington. You know, Bill Fleckenstein says, okay. I mean, he's been very critical of this bailout. He calls us bailout nation now. But he's saying if you're going to do this, then come in behind it and tighten up this system that's gotten so loosey-goosey. Do you sense in the halls of power where that would have to happen, Doug Elmendorf, a consensus emerging that it's time to shift course? The Greenspan years, the Greenspan attitude behind us and done. We need to tighten up more regulation. Is that out there, or as Peter Coy was suggesting, hey, you know, we'll take this hit and be back to the party?
I'm more optimistic than Bill that the consensus has shifted toward more aggressive regulation. I mean, he's certainly right to be concerned that we do follow up the immediate bailing of the boat with building a better system to prevent the next time the boat's about to sink. I think there is some real consensus that way, though. The Fed has come out with a proposal for significant tightening in the rules on subprime mortgages. I think that proposal is now out for public comment, and they will be finalized shortly. Even the Treasury Department has come out with, a first step in the direction of greater regulation. So I think the difference from 1998 in long-term capital management is twofold. One is that this financial crisis is having a bigger impact on the economy. We really skated through in the late 1990s. And secondly, this financial crisis is having an impact on many households because of the housing connection. I think both those factors will make this a higher political priority than improving regulation was a decade ago.
Jillian Tett, how does it look from London? We're all interconnected now. Do you see an emerging readiness in the United States to tighten up, get tougher, sort of, you know, get our wits back about us when it comes to assessing risk? Or are you anticipating more of the same? Would London have been happier if Bear Stearns had been, you know, allowed to fail, to set an example, a kind of complete rap on the knuckles, or not?
Well, I can certainly say the City of London would not have been happier if Bear Stearns had been allowed to fail, in the sense that it would have cost us, you know, a lot of jobs and a big knock-on impact on the rest of the banking system. But in essence, the problem is that this decade, the banking industry has stumbled on these new innovations which have enabled them to pump out and create credit more cheaply and more freely than ever before. And it's like any new innovation, be it the internet or the advance of nuclear power. You know, it's had many, many upsides, but innovation has basically spun out of control, not least of which because there's been very little oversight from society more broadly. I think right now there is certainly a growing consensus amongst policymakers here in Europe and in the US that something needs to be done to bring the innovation back into line to correct some of the excesses of recent years. But there isn't yet a really fundamental questioning of the banking model, of whether or not it's a good idea to have all this slicing and dicing of credit and debt. And in a sense, the trap is that people don't want to throw out the good side of innovation. You can't uninvent these techniques any more than you could uninvent the internet. But you have to find a way to control the bad side.
What about the reputation of the American finance industry? Is there such a thing anymore? Is it all just global? You know, does London look to the U.S. to try and clean up, get its house in order as a model for the rest of the world? Or it's sort of, never mind, we're moving on, our focus is elsewhere?
Well, the world is global in the sense that people here in London think that probably America has exported half of its toxic subprime problem, in that European institutions are holding a lot of these flawed assets,
yeah,
along with Asian ones as well. But right now, it certainly is the case that all eyes are on the Fed, insofar as a sense of panic does appear to be worse on Wall Street, and that's acting as a focus, if you like, of global concern.
Gillian Tett, Capital Markets Editor for the Financial Times, joining us from London. Gillian, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Let's go to Sandra in Penlaird, Virginia. Sandra, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a devoted follower of your show, and I thank you for having this. I must say that I didn't feel very happy when this program started, and now I feel like I'm about to have a heart attack.
I'm sorry about that.
It's just positively dreadful what has happened, and the gentleman in San Francisco, I believe, really addressed my concern. Actually, my worry, it's far beyond a concern, that the problem has been made evident, it has been spelled out, it has been analyzed almost to death. I hear precious little talk from the people with access to power, the people making policy, talking about this is what we are going to do to correct this problem and to make sure that it doesn't happen in the future. There has been none of this. I get the sense that, boy, this is really tough, but if we can just hang on until we can get back to our evil ways, everything will be okay. They'll forget about it. I'm just a cog in the wheel here myself. And I've spent most of my life, along with my husband, being very frugal and diligent about saving and investing wisely. And to be perfectly honest, based on the comments and the talk and talk and talk that I hear, I have really lost any motivation to save anything ever again or to advise anyone to.
And yet, what's the option, Sandra? I mean, you know, they say Social Security's in trouble. You've got to take care of yourself.
Well, if Social Security is in trouble now, what is it going to be like when the taxpayers have had to bail out all of these huge financial institutions? What is it going to be like if a bank fails in spite of everyone's best efforts? Where's the FDIC going to be? What's going to happen to my insured deposits in these banks? I mean, the taxpayer's only good for so much. You can't get blood out of a rock, and you can't ignore the psychological debacle that is being created by all of this. I mean, people on Wall Street and Washington may think that they have a real good grip on things, but if perception is reality, I really feel that I pretty much represent the reality of the vast majority of Americans. And the reality for us is that the game may very well be up, and until we see some real action and we start hearing people in power, the academics, the politicians, the analysts saying, this is what we are going to do. We see this as the problem. This is going to begin to be the solution. We are going to have oversight. We are going to have policemen. We are going to make these institutions prove to us that 2 + 2 does indeed equal 4 every day of the week, not just once in a while when we are telling our brokers, sell this stock, sell this bond.
Yep. Sandra, you're making good sense there. It's time for cool heads, even if it's cool anger. Let's get Bill Fleckenstein to respond. Bill, I'm sure Sandra speaks for many people with that perspective right now. Can you offer some hope, confidence that, you know, there's going to be a course correction here that should give Americans longer-term confidence in the markets that they're, so many are dependent on?
Well, Sandra's points are, you know, close to the ones that I was making, and regrettably, I don't see anything at the moment. I'm hoping Doug is correct in his observation that things are changing, and maybe beneath the surface they are, and we haven't seen them yet. But my concern is that there's little recognition of really how we did get here. It's almost like, well, it was a subprime crisis or whatever. No, that wasn't the problem. The problem was we allowed a housing bubble to go on and get out of control. We allowed deregulation to get out of control. The two married up together and created, you know, this beast that we have after all the bailouts that have gone on in the past, right? This has been 20 years in the making. And Sandra is correct to be concerned. I think the problems have gotten so large that they're bigger than the central banks, and there's going to be capitalism has been thwarted in that. I believe Greenspan's policies were sort of an attempt, although maybe not a conscious attempt, but an attempt to suppress the downside of capitalism. You know, we have booms and busts, and in the bust, it's not fun, but that clears away the dead wood, and we move on in a healthier way. The fact that people get a little bit hurt, they learn their lesson.
You're saying we tried to have it all party all the time and lost that cycle.
Exactly. When you stop that mechanism, then people take too much risk, you know, because they think, well, it will get bailed out. And that's what this is, where we are now, is taking way too much risk. How could these financial institutions allow themselves, or how could they be allowed to get leveraged to the point that they could be wiped out so quickly? Right?
Bill, you're talking like this, but you manage a hedge fund. You're an investor. What are you doing with your money now?
Well, I have not liked these policies for a long time. So my fund is set up to capitalize on the problems that come out of this. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do it that way. That's the way I've been forced to. So my fund, I wind up owning precious metals or foreign currencies, or I'm short stocks.
A sort of downside winner.
I've been precluded from owning, from being a long side investor, because I haven't liked these policies, and I've been afraid of what this would lead to. I've written columns on MSN. I've written a weekly column there, and I've been describing this as it was unfolding before it unfolded for some time. So I'm not surprised that we're here. I wish we weren't here. I really hope that what comes out of this pain and anguish is some real change, but I'm not holding my breath.
Douglas Elmendorf, you were an economist at the Federal Reserve from 2001 to 2006. Bill Fleckenstein is throwing some big grenades your way, or at least at the Greenspan era. Is he right? Did the Fed, you know, keep the punch flowing too long, too deep, sort of subvert the ordinary ups and downs and set us up for a big fall?
I think it's appropriate for the Fed to try to reduce the amplitude of business cycles. That's been, I think, a big success in monetary policy. Again, I would direct our attention to the other problems that Bill has emphasized, which are the regulation. I think what we have failed is to regulate financial markets that are innovating at a very rapid rate. And this innovation has brought some benefits, but also, as has become now very apparent, some large costs. And our goal has to be, I think, threefold. We need to have regulation that makes financial instruments more transparent, meaning all the way from individual households getting mortgages up through bank balance sheets and the risks. Secondly, we need to find a way to align incentives better so that people who are initiating some of these risks bear the cost of them. And a good example would be mortgage brokers who made mortgages without having to worry about whether they were paid off because they'd already sold the mortgage to somebody else. And the third thing we need to do is to set up systems that can unwind more gracefully when we have problems. So a good example is the securitization of mortgages work fine as long as the mortgages are being paid, but don't have a way to renegotiate the mortgages very easily when borrowers stop paying. I think we need to take very serious action. I agree with Bill very much about that. As I've said, I think I'm more optimistic that that action will be taken.
We're looking for a little optimism here. Doug, we've just got half a minute. What are your sort of best and worst-case scenarios now, given where we are, given all that's unfolded and unfolding here? Is there a chance this could snap back to good times in short order, or is there even a best-case scenario like that? And what's your downside fear?
The best-case scenario is that we have one or two more small financial institutions have trouble, but that financial markets move back towards some normality, and we have a mild recession, and by the end of this year, financial markets are stable and the economy is starting to grow again. The worst-case scenario is that we end up having to nationalize some other big chunk of the American financial system to avoid further cascading losses and depression.
Okay, somewhere in between those, we hope to make a life. Douglas Elmendorf, thank you very much for being with us this hour from the Brookings Institution. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Bill Fleckenstein with Fleckenstein Capital joining us today from Palm Springs, California. Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.